The practice of synthesizing a film, doing each frame for a film, means that you have to consider where each of these frames are going to be. And this means that a lot of attention is going to be paid to continuity or discontinuity. So, I feel that I've leaned very heavily on rhythms and on time structure and on the space structure within the frame, too. That's all a question of painting discipline. So I think it's always been there with my films, more or less. And this last film, where it's really a throwback to my first film, which was a geometric film, form phases, basically abstract geometric question of shapes moving around. And 69 is really going way back there. That's 1954. It's not my absolutely first film, but first showable one. The first film was exactly that, abstract film, 52 form phases. So I think for me it's just been more of the same. I wandered away from this kind of purism, I guess. Now I'm coming back to it.
Have you felt that there's any relationship to your work and musical structures?
Well, I don't. I suppose only to the extent that one is aware of structure again. There's no conscious relation at all. In fact, one of the things I wanted to get away from, because I felt that this was what happened in many early films, Fischinger, for all his charm and everything, his kind of literalism, the literal Mickey Mousing of image to sound, was one of the weaknesses of many abstract films. The idea of composing imagery to a track, and this is done all the time, of course, in commercial cinema, in commercials, I should say. You're given a track and then you cut your film accordingly. I think it's, for me, it was something to escape, to avoid. I always worked in silence, and what I wanted to emphasize was the visual structure of a thing. And sound had a way of taking over, so I always avoided it. I always put my sound on afterwards. And that's my attitude towards it. If there is a connection, it's certainly not, deliberate.
Right. I've always felt that the visual structure of a film was the primary thing, certainly in my own work. And it seems to me that your work, whether there's a track there or not, stands up visually very, very strongly. There's no doubt about that.
The first films, my first films were silent, anyhow, meant to be. And later films, I have long silent passages in them that makes everybody look back at the projection booth to see if something's died up there or not. hopefully not too often, but anyhow, I do have long periods of silence, palpable silence, where the image has to take over.
Well, I think what I'd ask you about now is how you felt about the new systems that are about to come out, which would enable people to buy films in the store in the form of cassettes for the various systems that play through television sets. Of course, there's been 8mm for sale around. I don't know, have you had any of your films for sale on 8mm?
Yeah, I've had them for sale in very modest ways, and I haven't sold many that way, but it's never been seriously approached. I think that will come. The idea of playing back over television sets, none of that really turns me on particularly. The opportunity to make money is always an interesting prospect, but physically, what will happen to the film and people and the audience, what happens there as far as the communication part of it goes, I don't know. I can't evaluate the difference. I don't concern myself with it. I see a rectangle up there that I'm filling up with a certain amount of activity. Part of my idea about bringing film into galleries was to allow more relaxed viewing of them. And this does change somewhat the way one goes about making a movie. You don't have that captive audience nailed down in their seats in a black room. And I suppose if I knew I were working directly for television, which I have done, I have to take into consideration this different atmosphere that people are sitting in. You know.
There's also, you never know what's going to happen if somebody buys something that they can play. It's like a phonograph record, and especially with television, this can be played back on black and white. Completely changed the whole aspect of the film.
Oh yeah,
you know, and
yeah. Well, black and white. Of course, seeing something that you made in color in black and white might be a bad experience. I've seen this happen. In fact, my films, But I feel if the things are basically strong underneath, I don't lean so heavily on color or on... my films are contrasting enough, I don't think an awful lot would get lost in the transfer. An awful lot. I mean, it would be just that much poorer, but as long as something is there, that something should be all right, and that, so it doesn't bother me.
Right. Obviously, the standard projection with a large screen has a different effect on an audience sitting in a dark room than somebody looking at a little television set. Hopefully, there'll be a rearrangement of what happens with television screens where the aspect of the motion picture ratio will be maintained. You have a screen that fills a whole wall or something.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure this will happen. There's such huge variation in presentation of films. That's one of the things as a filmmaker you have to get over right away. I've seen my films blown up Lincoln Center, for instance. I've seen them, I show them to myself on a 2 foot by 4 foot screen. I think you do lose a sense of scale. You get inside the picture, and it's very relative. There are different impacts, and that's good, but it's not something I can control anymore. So I don't worry about that. It's one of the uncontrolled things, and I don't work with it.
In other words, once the work is out in the world, it's a separate entity, unless...
Well, in a sense, the kinesthetic things that take place, if you make a stroke with a something that's as personal as a line drawn with your hand, and then it's blown up 1,500 times on a huge screen, so this line runs 40 feet across the wall instead of 2 inches across a card, then there must be a different feeling in the spectator. And yet, somehow, it doesn't seem to matter that much. I mean, you would think it would matter a hell of a lot, but a huge face on the screen is still a face. You know, there are so many other things involved that the scale change is relatively minor importance.
I think it has something to do with being used to cinematic language. Somebody sitting in a theater watching a face or a line knows that it's projected. The modern audience has become so familiar with the convention of cinema, we might call it.
Yeah.
It's like that interesting example at of the Eskimos when they first saw Flaherty's films, of rushing up to the screen and wanting to shake their own hands.
Oh, really?
Because they had first seen motion pictures and they figured there was their live image.
Yeah.
The convention of cinema had not yet taken place in their minds that they were watching a photographed image.
Yeah.
You see.
Yeah, I understand in India that there was a town, people would go to the cinema in this town from outlying towns, and they found out after quite some time that many of these people assumed they were seeing theater. Same situation. I don't think that it would have changed their impact to know that it was some trick. It would have changed the impact of the theatrical event. You know. When they did find out, I don't know what that did for them.
Oh, here we are. I guess that's caused by the... It's not recording that anyway, so we don't have to worry.
Right.
I was going to ask you a question about the fact that in one of your films and in a number of your mutoscopes, you've used playing cards, and whether this added or subtracted like from ambiguity, or you were interested purely in the design of them.
Yeah, I think it was just an arbitrary choice. Well, in a way... You flip cards and you shuffle them, and I think I just, since I always work with cards, it was natural to think in terms of playing cards too. And then I thought, well, I could flip anything. The point of this is that I got very deep into mixing diverse material, and in working with cards and working with discontinuity and changing the image very abruptly from one frame to the next. I got involved with those kinds of tensions, and I got to flipping everything. I flipped Bibles, decks of cards, books. The way I judge a book, like McLuhan's The Medium is a Massage, I flipped it, and it didn't flip very well, so I figured it wasn't much of a book. I mean, this is being a little bit silly, but the cards just came along as another thing you could flip in a way, and made for bright colors and a kind of, it's no symbolic inference there.
They seem to work very well, they certainly did. I noticed you had four kings or something, four queens.
Yeah. Well, of course, they have cards that they coincide in their imagery, and a lot of places the design does, and other places it doesn't. Where it doesn't, it's kind of interesting mixture you get then.
Well, I'd like to ask you about the moving things that move across the floor. I remember at Rauschenberg's when I first saw them, they were like little flat platforms. They would come to one wall, and they had a motor that reversed, and then they would keep going in another direction. And then, I don't know what the, how they progressed, but you got to the little point, to the point where you had these little objects that were in the Japanese World Fair.
Yeah.
They're in the same family, right?
Right. Well, not little objects, the ones in the, in Osaka are 6 feet high and 6 feet in diameter.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. But they are the same family, they're exactly the same things, they just got bigger. What you saw, what you're thinking of, are the souvenirs that were made from those big pieces. The situation in Japan is a pavilion for a Pepsi-Cola company, or as I refer to it now, a well-known soft drink company. Anyhow, that's...
Right. I think we'll stick to that. Let's get that clear. The pavilion in Japan is for a well-known soft drink company.
Right.
Right. Right. Because we'll have to cut that other out.
Oh. that
we won't give
happy.
Them that. Huh? Right. We won't give them that.
Anyhow, that was the pavilion was not the building itself, but everything around it, inside and outside of it, was designed by... a group of artists, including myself, working through an organization called Experiments in Art and Technology, EAT, in New York.
Right.
And we put that thing together. It took us 2 years, and it's now operating, as far as I know, in Japan. Now, that consists of several elements, and one of the things outside, my major contribution, my own, were these big things I call floats. Other people call creepies. These things you're describing, they're large dome-shaped objects, and they're motorized underneath by batteries to move very, very, very slowly. And since we were talking about film, the way I got into these, or at least a connection to film, is obviously one of motion. Ironically enough, these things move at a speed so slow as to be imperceptible, almost, until you're standing there and one bumps into you, you don't really notice it. And of course with the films, they're ultra fast, my films, so fast, there again, you almost don't realize that they're moving. It breaks up the motion so much. So I, looking back at what I've done, I guess there is a connection. I'm playing again with thresholds of perception very closely, you see. And in the case of the concrete object, here's something that's improbable that it would move, and looking at it, and lo and behold, it does. With cinema, the other way around. Anyhow, what more can I...
The reception of these in Japan, I heard you say something about the Japanese felt they were too slow. They move at a similar speed to the ones that move on the floor.
Yeah. Yeah, they're very slow. Well, the irony of that is, of course, that the reason I got involved with the Japanese project at all was because of a reference a critic made to my objects as being similar to the rocks in temple gardens in Japan. These rocks were supposed to move, apparently move, anyhow, if you sat there long enough and contemplated them. And he thought that this was kind of a poetic equivalent to what I was doing. And this rang a bell for me. It made me, when the opportunity came to do something in Japan, I got interested in this kind of transcultural situation. The upshot, though, the funny thing was that was this other reaction I got after the whole project was over, the effect that the Japanese, ordinary Japanese in any case, no longer or never did really dig this pace, you know, that this is confined to maybe the elite Japanese or to another time in that culture. So I got my comeuppance there, although I didn't ever work with the Japanese, with a Zen idea, really, and not consciously. So no loss of input there.
Yeah, the actual speed doesn't have that much to do with how you perceive the object, though. The very fact that it's moving, it could be, I suppose if it were moving at 50 miles an hour, it would be rather frightening to be standing near it.
Yeah.
But something like being on the middle of the Indianapolis Speedway with them all free running.
Yeah.
But
well, this was suggested to me by the directors of this well-known soft drink company. Not really that speed, but to speed them up. And it was difficult for me to explain to them that the idea was more of creating a presence rather than some kind of spectacle, some kind of jazzy situation, that the whole essence of these things was in the inscrutability of its motion, the fact that you couldn't predict where it's going. As soon as they're speeded up to fast enough so you can tell where it's going, then it's a predictable situation and instant monotony.
Yeah, in fact, it sort of would remind me of those old electric cars that used to be out at Coney Island, where you would drive around in circles, and it would take away the whole mysterious quality of the object that moves but doesn't have a necessary particular utilitarian view in mind.
Yeah,
the very shape of them is not just.
Well, here's what the point of the things is that kinetic sculpture is not something I invented. Pieces that have articulated members that move, a piece of sculpture that has an element that revolves or something of this sort. This has been around for some time, and it's only a normal extension of the medium. But what I felt with these, what I hope to do with these, they're basically inanimate as objects. They are rather dumb looking, you know, in that sense, in a particular sense. They're amorphous shapes, somewhat geometrical, but not too specific. They do look static when you look at them. When you realize that they're moving around, and of course there's several of them moving in relation to each other, then motion itself is something that is outside of them. It's not a part of them. You don't have a piece with something moving on it, but the piece itself is moving. And what I hope happens is that the movement is an essence like the air around them. And in this way, I've isolated motion itself again, and that's what I was trying to do with film. And by going back and forth over the flow of motion, I'm sort of stopping it at times so that you could sense it when it did get into action. And this is again maybe a connection between film and these other things I've done.
Right, it's almost like a sort of mechanical painting dance. Sort of like free form. None of these objects, like two of these things could come together and the engines would reverse, wouldn't they? And
yeah.
Then go apart.
Well, that's right. They recompose themselves on this flat terrace, in this case in Japan. And in every case where these run around, they have autonomy and they do get into situations. They create anecdotes by bumping into things. But as far as formal composition is concerned, it's random, if you like. And this pleases me very much. In a way, it's really creating, because I've started something and then it goes on its way. It's a kind of Pygmalion situation.
Right. Well, we're now going to talk about another one of Bob's kinetic works. The idea of kinetic sculpture, as you said, wasn't yours. And there's a whole relationship, but I believe there's something that's really involved in those mutoscopes, which if you go back into film history, this was the first way in which films were looked at. They were looked at as little peep show type of things. In fact, Edison felt that there was no future in the movies. They were just little peep show machines.
Uh-huh.
And he more or less never really backed his invention because he didn't think much of it.
Yeah. Well, that happens a lot. Well, for me, there's one challenge that as soon as I got into making mutoscopes, I went to buy one, by the way, downtown, and I think they were going for one of the old ones, a guy who collected them on 44th Street, and he had just sold a batch of them to Walt Disney, who was putting them in his place out there. What's it called?
Disneyland?
Disneyland, right.
Mm-hmm.
And And so this guy suddenly had a raised his price on them, and that's what got me into making them myself. I decided that the hell with that, I'll make my own. So anyhow, once I got into them, I realized that of course I had made a batch of them. I'd made them before in Paris, as a matter of fact. But when I got back here, I was thinking maybe I could use the mechanics of the existing ones. Anyhow, the challenge was to make a continuous. An endless, as opposed to a flip book or a movie, you had a loop situation all of a sudden. And this made for a different challenge in terms of composing something that had no beginning and end. You could stand there and crank all day long. Hopefully, by turning it constantly, it would reveal new things. And so many of my mutoscopes had very intricate things going on. You can't find the beginning or the end. And this was a new challenge compositionally. That was one thing. The other thing was the physicality of an exposed mutoscope where you can see all the cards. I started sculpting them out. In a sense, I can show you one. You can see one right over there. The radio audience can't see it, but it's carved. The cards have been chopped away on the corners progressively more and then diminishing again. So the whole thing looks something like one of those air-cooled motors with the cooling fins that have been sculpted somewhat to make room for the spark plug and so forth. Now these carvings, of course, when you flip them and you stop the card at a given point, there's a trip mechanism that turns it into a cinematic machine, then the change of the shape of the card becomes a kind of flowing change, whereas the thing when you look at it static, you see just these sculpted divots in the side of it. I began punching holes in them and treating it as kind of a sculptural object that also had this other, that could be, it was kind of a three-dimensional movie, if you like. It's like the templates on a sailboat. The bulkheads on a sailboat that change shape, you know, they're intersections in a flowing shape, and this is what I got interested in.
They take on different aspects when you use different materials. I noticed in some you used clear, like plastic, and in others they were interspersed red and silver cards, which had some had been painted slightly, and some had been left as clear.
Yeah. Well, the great excitement for me about the mutoscope is that you can see at the same time, you can see the individual elements going into this recreated image when you flip it. In other words, you see what goes into the makings of this image you're getting. At the same time, you're looking at the image. And that's why some of the clear plastic ones, you can see from one card right through to the next, and at some, it
forms like a superimposition.
That's right, yeah.
Well, one thing about being up here in the country on the edge of the Palisades is it's a beautiful place to live. It must also be a beautiful place to work.
Yeah, well, I wish everybody had this opportunity, as a matter of fact. I don't know, there's a lot to be said. I've always lived in Paris. I lived in the city, but Paris is like a country town. There's no real, or the center of Paris, it doesn't gradually build up to the center. No matter where you live in Paris, you're living in a kind of suburb. Where I am here is really it's fake country. It's close enough to be a suburb, but it's country enough so that I can go out and sit in the woods here, which I do a lot of. I'm basically a voyeur, and I spend long hours just very quietly sitting, very quietly so I can listen and so I don't disturb things. And I think somehow this work gets into the work, and it's very important to me, as a matter of fact. I've got a bunch of little fish in a pond up there, and I don't make direct connections very often with nature and my work, direct connections, but I make an awful lot of, in my mind, corollaries.
I remember the last shot in one film where you come out the door. The film had been very quick, it's almost all single frames, fist fight, right?
Yeah.
And the last shot, you see your feet, and then you like pan up to a shot of the sun.
Yeah, well, I got fed up with my very hermetic situation, which I like also. I like to work in very the tight quarters I've contrived for my stand and all that. in a very precise situation with vis-a-vis my camera and my material, so I have extraneous stuff out of the way. I like that, but then I think in that case I decided, you know, I have to break with that completely every once in a while. And I did it very literally there. I unscrewed my camera from the stand and ran it while I kept the film running through it while I took it off the stand and really literally walked outside with it and showed my feet going out through the door. Yeah, it's a kind of literalism. I mean, this is what I wanted, you know, it's to make it the experience direct. And when you do a thing like that, of course, I'm surprised you noticed that in a way. It is kind of a jolt in there, and different from everything else. But
well, I must admit that I didn't notice it the first time.
I see. Yeah.
Having worked on the 8mm reduction of it once,
I saw it
a number of times.
Yeah.
So I might say that I'm not any more perceptive about your work than many other people are, except I've had the opportunity to see them more times.
Well, you see, I don't believe that film should be seen several times to be appreciated. I think that it ought to give the essence of itself the first viewing. And so things like that happen are all through the film. I don't count on them being seen. I don't count on that being important. But it was important that I did that myself, that I knew it was in there, that's all.
Yeah. The fellow's soaring wood, that got to me the first time. Somehow that it seemed like it really was an incongruous shot that you put in there to break the...
Recreation, maybe.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's it. It's a matter of working in impulses, and... they come to an end, and when they do, then something else takes place. The same way I work, all my work is, I quite often work in antidotes to what I've done before, and I work in opposites. And that's why I jump from painting to film and back again, and from sculpture to film, and these are ploys to provoke myself, keep things going, you know. There's always something dangling over there that has to be taken care of, and I drop this and run over there to take care of that. Keep a lot of things going that way.
You had built more or less everything around here yourself, didn't you? Like the animation stand.
Well, that's some kind of sickness too. I once made a synchronizer out of some thread bobbins, and I made my own splicer.
Did it work?
It worked miserably. And the splicer had a purpose. I could make very, very thin splices with it, so I didn't have to go through A and B roll. It was one of those cases of doing a lot more work to avoid a little bit of work. I did a lot more extra work. But it's also a question of false economy, in a sense, psychologically important to not be too involved with technology, to sacrifice expressive involvement, you know.
Right.
I'm very leery of cameras, and I'm not particularly interested. I get interested in lenses and things at weird times, but... the idea of surrounding myself with an awful lot of apparatus and then sitting down to work is wrong. I think I like to keep it very simple.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Robert Breer.
Imagine an eye unruled by man-made laws of perspective. An eye unprejudiced by compositional logic. An eye which does not respond to the name of everything, but which must know each object encountered in life through an adventure of perception.
It's Movies on the Radio on WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson. Radio for open ears. Movies on the Radio is a monthly simulcast accompanying the Filmont Media Project's outdoor film screening series, Sidewalk Cinema, at 100 Main Street in Filmont, New York. You're tuned in to our monthly radio showcase of the sounds of experimental cinema and experiments in sound from artists, filmmakers, and makers of all types in Columbia and Greene counties and across the world. On this month's show, we'll be spending an hour with film, video, and sound art that explores and blurs the boundaries between the mediums of cinema and the radio. I'm calling this episode Flicker and Frequency: Hybrid Adventures in Experimental Moving Images and Terrestrial Radio. Why flicker and frequency? Well, flicker, of course, for that phenomena that makes the movies possible at all. The regular, intermittent flashing of still images, which through quirks of the human visual apparatus, we register as moving images. Frequency, of course, putting the F in FM. The propagation of modulated electromagnetic frequencies through which you're hearing my voice now. We put out a call to filmmakers, radio artists, and sound designers, asking them to reflect on the affinities and contradictions between these two media forms. What happens when the seen and the unseen, light and sound, film and radio collide? Well, stick around for the next hour and find out. Sidewalk Cinema projector all warmed up, so let's get to the evening's first movie on the radio. I am queuing up No Video, a new video work by Akla Shugin Noksi. Akla Shugin is a Muskogee and Talagee transgender, two-spirit native artist, experimental filmmaker, and radio producer. They position No Video in their broader practice, which attempts to deconstruct settler colonial structures that confine indigenous existence and expression. No Video explores the ways in which both video and radio participate in the construction of a certain kind of time, linear, ordered, and surveilled time, through a haunting and eerie montage of footage of internet-accessed security cameras and sound from a shortwave universal time count broadcast.
At the tone, 6 hours, 58 minutes, coordinated universal time. At the tone, 6 hours, 59 minutes, coordinated universal time. At the tone, 7 hours, 0 minutes, coordinated universal time. National Institute of Standards and Technology time. This is radio station WWV, Fort Collins, Colorado, broadcasting on internationally allocated standard carrier frequencies of 2.5, 5, 10, 15, and 20 megahertz, providing time of day, standard time interval, and other related information. Inquiries regarding these transmissions may be directed to the National Institute of Standards and Technology, radio station WWV, 2000 East County Road 58, Fort Collins, Colorado, 80524. At the tone, 7 hours, 1 minute, coordinated universal time.
So that was No Video by Achla Chuginuxi. If you are joining us live at the Sidewalk Cinema, you'll no doubt have had a chance to appreciate the way No Video weaves together uncanny pixelated images of surveilled sites across the globe. Deserted beaches, empty churches, or just snow smearing into static. This viewer, at least, is left with the sense that in the same way that a universal time ticked out on a shortwave radio is really a kind of no time, the world that's constructed from the images we get from globalized digital video streams is really a kind of no place. But against what I think No Video properly diagnoses as modern media's capacity to alienate and isolate us, I'd like to pose our next entry in tonight's lineup. Skottegatan FM. Every day at noon, Karen Warner broadcasts from Skottegatan FM, a micro FM station based in her apartment on the quiet street of Skottegatan in Bergen, Norway. Skottegatan FM makes a second transmitter available for neighbors to borrow and transmit from their apartments. The daily broadcast at noon features a weekly roster of guests and programs about Mini-FM. Poetry, Norwegian language lessons, dream interpretation, surreal traffic and weather reports, and dance music. Since Norway is the only country to abandon its FM infrastructure and switch to digital audio broadcast, most of the Bergen FM dial is static. Skottgaten FM emerges from these ruins.
Hello, hello, hello. Skottgaten FM coming to you at noontime. I do want to say that having a radio station like Skottgaten FM, having one, shepherding one, stewarding one, it's really great. There's a lot to be said for having it in your dining room. So Skottgaten FM, which is really a transmitter, a microphone, really, that's all you need. You know, yeah, transmitter, some kind of microphone, and a mixer's helpful. So you can have different inputs and balance the sounds. So that's really all you need to do a radio station. And when you declare a radio station, it suddenly becomes, it's kind of like you've got a pot of soup, and suddenly people can, you can ask people for their ingredients, and then suddenly you start to make a big stew out of the carrot that this person brought and the garlic that that person had lying around. And then that person had some beans. And then before you know it, you have this big soup. And maybe it even brings us together by the soup. That's one way of thinking about Skottgaten FM and radio. What is that wonderful sound? The amazing thing about Skottgaten FM and a small-scale radio station is that we share the outside soundscape so that the transmission from 88.6 FM in any audible range is also hearing the outside sounds. So we're all kind of participating in a kind of duet. But I think there's even another layer to that duet, which is the beautiful, beautiful sound of industry, some kind of droney machine. And then this person being me at the microphone, and then you listening. It's kind of like hard for me to actually imagine you. Maybe that's okay. My morning coffee, because I woke so late. Maybe you're a future you. I've been thinking a lot about, you know, different forms of just making a self, really, well, different forms of separating, I guess. It's not the right word. Different forms of fear. This show has really been, this week, I should say, has been inspired inadvertently by my friend Ricarda and her bringing up on Thursday this poem called Mein Denken by Monica Rink. This is a favorite poem of Ricarda's. And it came to her mind because the first line is, Ich habe heute Mittag mein Denken gesehen. Today at noon, I saw my thoughts. Hearing sounds on the street. Today at noon, I've seen my thoughts. What about heard? That's what Ricarda does. She likes to listen to her thoughts. I'm kind of listening to my thoughts. and externalizing them with you, Scott Tegatin FM, and with you, listener, and still feeling that vibrational drone that's coming from, I think, the fjord. It's a great prompt for some kind of a free association. And I've been wanting to free associate again about Scott Tegatin FM, to get to know you, Scott Tegatin FM. Maybe it invites you to experiment and ramble in your mind, to get to know your mind, to listen to your mind, to listen to your mind. The mind and the window. The window has been a recurring theme in you, Scott Tegatin FM. The window that separates, but also is a portal to the street. It's both a barrier and a portal. Maybe this is the same as radio. It's like a portal for sure, but it's also a separation. You know, we're not face to face or body near body.
That was Scott Tegatin FM by Karen Warner. When Movies on the Radio put out a call for experimental film work that responded to the radio, one of the first entries we received was this video by Karen. And what I love about it is not only that it feels like a postcard from a friend I didn't know I had, but also that when we project the images of Karen's lovely, quiet Bergen neighborhood here on the sidewalk cinema screens on Main Street of a tiny, rural, upstate New York village, it feels like we're opening up a little wormhole or portal, using a little movie and radio magic to say hello to a distant neighbor. That was Scott Tegatin FM by Karen Warner. Karen is an artistic research fellow at the Bergen Art Academy, working primarily with radio, and she was the 2019-2020 Wave Farm Radio Artist Fellow. Visit her website at karenwarner.net. Next up at the Sidewalk Cinema, we have another piece of video and sound art that explores sound's relationship to space and memory. Boundary Mind is a result of a collaboration between UK-based violinist Linda Jankowska, Atlanta-based composer and improviser Catherine Young, and Chicago-based filmmaker Kira McKenzie. We'll be hearing sounds drawn from an evening-length electroacoustic sound piece and aggregating multimedia installation that explores and transgresses the geographical, cultural, psychological, and musical boundaries that impact how we share our past, present, and future selves with others. In the video, everyday objects with sentimental meaning and memory-evoking power have been shared, recorded, and remixed, filmed, and animated, and collected into woven tapestries. Boundary Mind by filmmaker Kira McKenzie and collaborators Linda Jankowska and Catherine Young. To learn more about this project, you can visit boundarymind.com. Next up in the Sidewalk Cinema, we have an untitled piece from Maximilian Luc Proctor. Maximilian is a French-American filmmaker and critic with a special interest in the avant-garde. He's a contributing editor for Photogenet and a curator for Fracto Experimental Film Encounter. Maximilian's contribution to tonight's lineup is a bit of a departure from what we've seen and heard so far, in that he asks us to imagine with him just what a film without images might be like.
It began, as these things so often do, with an idea of silence. Of darkness. Of questioning on a gloomy day. What a film what a film without image or sound feels like. We'd been living in Berlin for about a year, and the move wasn't easy. Heidelberg was simple enough in its absence of opportunities. By not having a real direction, I had direction. But eventually, it was time to move, and that meant a new direction. New work and new paths. New projects to be found and created. I spent the first 3 months just losing time, losing joy, losing money to my previous landlord. And it wasn't exactly a time of many new ideas. It was just a heavier gray. It was a new city with a It was a new city which took more and seemingly offered less at the outset. Nearly 4 years on now, it's easy to say that it's given me a lot being here, but it's taken a lot in the process. After we lived in Berlin for about a year, and after I tried my first serious film, a short film, which incorporated ideas I wanted to execute relating to experimental visual loops, sound loops, and somehow coercing those into a narrative. I made that film and had then nowhere to take it. no one to show it to. Nothing to be done as a next step. It supposedly played in one horror film festival in the United States, though I wasn't able to find concrete proof. So after we had lived in Berlin for 1 year, I had the idea one day, on one of my many ridiculous, lonely lunches eaten out in a restaurant, because at that time, I constantly sought stimulation from the outside. I was eating, and the noise of the clattering silverware and the conversation in the concrete room continued to bounce around. It was this swirl of commotion, and no one seemed really excited, but everyone was busy. A microcosm of this city. And I closed my eyes and listened. And I visualized a film for making us all blind. A blank screen and a soundscape. The sounds of everyday life and traffic and walking around in a bustling Berlin. And the film would be somehow the experience of a blind individual. But the conceit didn't end there, because I wanted, by some miracle, for our blind protagonist to regain their sight. And first only in pieces. Pieces of barely visible flashing color. Pieces not of concrete vision, but of consciousness materialized. And the more I focused on this film, the less possible it seemed to actually make it. I excitedly would tell friends about it. They agreed that it sounded very interesting. And then I didn't make the film. After a while, I realized that my strength lies in the making. So I just have to make it first. And
that was an untitled piece by Maximilian Luke Proctor. We have one final selection to round out the evening with you tonight on Movies on the Radio. Unified Fields is a 16mm film by Brandon Wally. It captures a hot summer weekend and an odd sense of interconnectedness, yet isolation that's manifested by light waves, radio waves, and heat waves colliding in the ether, meshing with a family captured on celluloid. Brandon is a filmmaker and curator based in Detroit, Michigan. He creates 16mm, Super 8mm, and digital films that explore the interconnectedness and abstractions between humanity, ecology, industry, and technology. For over a decade, his films have been screened widely in festivals, museums, and cinematheques. Brandon has taught film production at various institutions, and he is the program director of Corktown Cinema and former co-director of the Detroit Film Center. Brandon has been Media City International Film Festival's regional artist curator since 2008, and he is head of the festival screening committee. Brandon is also currently an artist fellow with Kresge Arts in Detroit. Here's Brandon's film, Unified Fields.
Pi equals 3.14415896five three five eight eight nine seven nine three two eight eight four one nine seven one six nine three nine nine three seven five one zero five eight two zero nine seven four nine four four five nine two zero seven eight one six four zero six two eight six two zero eight nine nine.
Seven packets for three,
couldn't take it for 3 days.
Well, that about wraps up this month's episode of Movies on the Radio. We hope you've enjoyed this special episode dedicated to the intersection of film and radio. And if you like a little movie with your radio, why not mark your calendar for May 26th when WGXC will be having its 10th anniversary drive-in event and celebration at the Greenville Drive-In. There'll be DJ sets from WGXC programmers Lunar Moss, Jeff Economy, Alana Metlock, Mayuko Fujino, DJ Var, and Dan Seward of the Battlefield Earth Show. There'll also be live performances by Jess Spear, Jen Cutler, Anna Fries, and Stephen Merritt of the Magnetic Fields. We'll also be screening The Powers of Ten by Ray and Charles Eames and a film by Heath Iverson. That's me. So come on out May 26th and celebrate 10 years of WGXC, community and listener-supported radio for open ears. You can visit wavefarm.org to get your tickets now. We will be back with another episode on April 8th at 7 p.m. and the second Thursday of each month here on WGXC. Meantime, check us out online at philmontmediaproject.org. That's Philmont with an F. Or you can find the Philmont Media Project on Facebook and Instagram, where you can stay updated on our Media Labs projects, programs, and workshops. If you have comments, questions, or are a moving image maker based in the Hudson Valley and would like to share your work with us, you can contact us at philmontmediaproject@gmail.com. Movies on the Radio and The Sidewalk Cinema are productions of the Philmont Media Project and are made possible, in part, with funds from the Decentralization Program, a re-grant program of the New York State Council on the Arts with the support of Governor Andrew M. Cuomo and the New York State Legislature, administered in Columbia County by CREATE. Tonight's event was broadcast live on Wave Farm's WGXC 90.7 FM, radio for open ears in New York's Upper Hudson Valley, made possible by Wave Farm's Transmit Partner Program. Tune in online at wavefarm.org/listen. Philmont Media Project is a proud member of the Purpose Cooperative Makerspace in Philmont, New York.
Was it the movie or the making of Fitzcarraldo? Was someone learned to love again? I can't remember, it's not the same as I don't know. Virgin with a memory. Was it the movie or the making of Fitzcarraldo? Where your mother decided to fashion herself after the sanctity we left on the shelf. She wanted blood, all she got was sacrifice. She wanted blood, all she got was sacrifice. She wanted blood, all she got was sacrifice. Virgin, without a memory, now's your chance to be free. Of all those favorite bands we ditched for one that's grander, no use for a name to the makeup, it's all the same. The singing at the sun, no. The singing at the sun, no. The singing at the sun, no. In love with our peers, we tasted life with the stars. Anticlimactic as Mars was still. A red earth with no way of knowing. The silver colossus exists just to be growing. A red earth with no way of knowing. The silver colossus exists just to be growing. Again, will someone learn to love again? Will someone learn to love again?